I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Six men have escaped and two have died in the months since Kansas City began housing its inmates at the Heartland Center for Behavioral Change. It's a rehab facility downtown that was never designed to serve as a jail. Today, how the Heartland Center came to house about 100 of Kansas City's inmates and the changes all this has forced them to make to their daily operations. Then, once upon a time, the rivalry between sports teams in Kansas City and Oakland burned bright. These days, though, the competition just isn't as fierce. We'll find out how the often unfriendly competition defined an era and put our cities in the national spotlight. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. This summer, when Kansas City needed a new place to house prisoners, it turned to the Heartland Center for Behavioral Change at 17th and Prospect. It didn't work out very well. After six prisoners escaped from the center and two others died, Mayor Quentin Lucas was heard to say that he'd been incredibly underwhelmed by the center's performance. But the president and the CEO of the Heartland Center pointed out that his facility was never built to be a detention center. The city has now in the process of reversing course and has agreed to again house its prisoners back in the Jackson County Jail. Joining us now is the president and CEO of the Heartland Center. That's Kyle Mead. He has more than 20 years experience in the behavioral health industry and at the Heartland Center. Kyle, it's nice to have you. Thanks for taking some time.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
You said that the Heartland Center wasn't really set up to take inmates. Given that, why did you guys at the Heartland Center agree to take city prisoners if you weren't set up to handle them?
Basically, the city approached us and gave us the information about the deadline that they had, the end of the contract with Jackson County Detention Center.
Right.
We had some space available. We were probably one of the more uniquely qualified facilities in the city, given our experience with criminal justice-involved people and our location being close to the courthouse, very close to the services for the municipal court staff, and that we had been working with the Missouri Department of Corrections and previously the Bureau of Prisons to provide services for individuals for really about 35 years. And so while our facility was not meant to be a detention center, we thought we could allow the city some time to be able to address the needs of the city more thoroughly by offering that service.
So you thought you could help the city out in a pinch. Am I hearing you right?
Yes, exactly.
Was the money, was it a financially attractive offer to your center?
No. I mean, they're paying us for the services that we're providing, but we're a nonprofit organization. We're probably going to maybe break even. But if anything, it's probably going to end up being a loss for us. But as a nonprofit organization, we're here to serve our community. The idea of those individuals who are under detention being in another location other than Kansas City where they are connected to those resources was something we wanted to try to avoid and to see if we could help.
You ended up taking 100 inmates here, city prisoners, if you will. Was that more than you anticipated? Because that strikes me as just a lot of people coming in the door for a center like yours.
Well, and that's not even completely accurate in and of itself. Yeah, the number of beds is 110, but we took in over 600 people in the month of October, well over 500 people in the month of September.
Meaning that the people come in and go in and go out pretty quickly. They're there for a few days and they check out.
Yeah, and sometimes even a matter of hours. And that was not something that we anticipated. Just the number of people that come through who are arrested and are arraigned and then are released very quickly, the laundry facilities, the food, those were things that caught us off guard, quite frankly.
You're talking about the city prisoners who came in the door. They would just be there for a short amount of time.
Every single day, multiple times a day, Kansas City Police Department brings us arrestees that are due for arraignment. Oftentimes, they're only there for a number of hours.
Mm-hmm. What changes did you make at your facility to make Heartland more suitable for inmates as opposed to patients, I guess?
Well, we added a lot of security measures. We went from a facility that did not have locked doors on it to having the doors being locked. We added quite a few measures in terms of being able to have a response for behavior problems. So we created cool down rooms, as we referenced them. We instituted some benches and some opportunities to actually secure people via leg irons and handcuffs. That was not something we had ever had before. Mm-hmm. We instituted a lot of video camera equipment that allowed for us to have supervision over people. We instituted quite a few changes in regards to how food service would work, other things that mm-hmm. would enable us to be able to secure people better than we ever had before.
So from your standpoint, how did all this work out? Again, I opened up the segment here by saying six folks had escaped, two others died, the mayor not happy with what happened here. From your standpoint, how did it work out?
Well, certainly I don't feel like that it's worked out well. However, I have the perspective that says that for well over 12 years and probably closer to 15 and multiple assessments, our community has done the work and has identified the need to build a jail. And it's not the current administration specifically, but multiple administrations within our city government have known that this was a problem. It's not like the Jackson County Detention Center contract was meant to be a long-term fix. Mm-hmm. We simply wanted to be able to help them as they work towards a more permanent and frankly, a much needed solution to this to build a detention facility. They've needed it for many years and it's just failed to get done mm-hmm. and it's time for that to happen. Mm-hmm. So yes, it has not gone well. It was not intended for this to be something that was a long-term solution. Mm-hmm. We just wanted to be able to offer a very short-term opportunity in order for the city to be able to address this need more consistently with what mm-hmm. any municipality of the city would do.
How did it come to pass that six prisoners were managed to escape? Can you give us a general sense of what went on?
Every single case was individual in its nature, but certainly a facility such as ours, which is an old elementary school, there were things that people were able to do that we did not anticipate. And
things like what?
They were able to pull some diamond plate metal screens from a window area and were able to get enough movement in that to be able to slide through and get out the window. Mm-hmm. We had a situation with a fairly new corrections officer who made a mistake and allowed someone to be taken out of their restraints, and that person was able to leave. We had our facility was originally designed with the Kansas City Fire Department to have doors that were electromagnetic that would release instantly when an alarm was pulled. And we had a detainee who pulled the alarm and was able to identify the doors that had been released and mm-hmm. were able to escape. Those are all examples of what we've experienced and what we've responded to.
So, again, given the transition you guys had to make from basically a mental health facility to a detention facility, it doesn't sound like you're surprised that these kinds of things wound up taking place.
I wouldn't say that I'm not surprised. I certainly anticipated and had hoped that we would have a better overall outcome than what we've had. I do know that the people with the city that I've been working with frequently throughout this process have made the point to say, look, we knew there were going to be hiccups. We knew there were going to be challenges that we were going to face. And I'm not trying to say that anybody's okay with what we've done, but we've actually successfully served well over 2,500 people. Mm-hmm. And our goal here was public safety and to be able to allow these individuals to be able to get connected to services in our community. And we've been able to start to move in that direction, which I think is extremely important. If individuals are housed outside of our community, they're not being connected with primary care, mental health services, substance use disorder services, homeless services.
Right here at home. Yeah.
Where they're going to need those services. And those individuals are going to come back to this community and be ill-equipped to not need detention again, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
We want to be able to address this problem.
Yeah. As I mentioned, two inmates died. What happened there?
Well, those cases that are under current investigation, I'm not going to be able to speak about.
There's, sure.
There was an individual who attempted a suicide, and he left our facility alive because of the response of our staff and what a good job that they had done. Mm-hmm. I do understand that since he was taken to an area hospital that he has passed away, which is very unfortunate, and my deepest sympathies go out to those families who lost an individual
yeah.
here.
You know, I should point out here, Kyle, that the individuals we're talking about here, the prisoners, if you will, these are tend to be less serious crimes than the kinds of inmates who are being held at the Jackson County Detention Facility. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I don't think that's an accurate statement at all. Hmm. I think every single individual who is arrested by the Kansas City Police Department, no matter what the nature of their offense is, has been coming to our facility. Now, sometimes we're able to then have them transfer out to either Vernon County or Johnson County, but we have had to deal with the full array. If huh. it's a Kansas City Police Department arrestee, there's no screening that allows for a lower level offense only to come to the Heartland Center. That was also something that we did not anticipate. We really believed that those other contracts were going to house those individuals and we would be dealing with lower level offenders at our facility.
But you're saying that wasn't the case at all.
No, it hasn't been the case at all. And I'm not saying that they don't ever go to those other locations, but what I'm saying is they first come through our facility.
Did you communicate that frustration with the city and say, hey, the deal here was lower level offenders and we're getting and seeing something entirely different?
We communicate on a regular basis about that. We work together to be able to come up with the right solution for those individuals. But we did not realize that we would be taking on the full array of those cases. But we became aware very, very quickly, and we've tried very hard to be responsive, and we try to work with those municipal court staff to make sure that proper placement happens as quickly as it possibly can. This has been a collaborative and cooperative relationship with challenges.
Hmm. What kind of supervision and oversight did the city wind up providing here? Did they staff your facility with police officers? Were there other types of supervision that was made available as this situation began to unfold?
No. They do offer transportation officers, and so those individuals do manage transportation to courts, to primary care services. Those individuals are in our facility on a regular basis. It's the Kansas City police officers that bring us the individuals, and they're there through that initial intake process. But no, the staffing has been totally the responsibility of Heartland Center.
Were you able to separate the prisoners who were being brought to your facility by the police from the patients that you were serving already?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, mm-hmm. This was a space that was not being utilized at the time that the city approached us, and we were able to keep complete separation from other services. We operate five different clinics in the Kansas City area. Mm-hmm. It's not all in one building.
Kyle, I can't help but wonder, if you had to do this all over again, would you do it again?
No, I don't think I would do things the same way that we did. I still believe that Heartland Center offers this community very valuable services, and that some of the individuals who are receiving their services through the municipal courts are still appropriate for what Heartland Center brings and offers our community. And I still believe there's an opportunity for us to continue to work with those municipal court staff to be able to provide care and services for those individuals. But detention and receiving the arrestees is something that is outside of our scope to be able to do the job that's necessary. And again, I've known that all along. I believe the city needs to build a jail and to staff it with government employees, just like most municipalities do. It's time for that to happen.
You're saying this incident, this involvement with the Heartland Center really puts a spotlight on the lack of a proper city jail facility that you say needs to happen.
Absolutely. And yeah. I think we're about to do our third assessment. And I can tell you, Steve, they're going to tell you the same thing that the other two assessments that our taxpayers have already paid for. This city needs to build a detention facility.
Hey, do you anticipate now that your involvement with the city and its prisoners is about to end? There was stories last week that the city is renegotiating with the county again to take its inmates and prisoners over there. Do you anticipate that happening now and the Heartland Center's involvement ending here shortly?
I think the involvement in a detention facility is going to end very, very soon. I don't know all those details. I still believe that there are things that we could offer to the city that might help their reliance upon detention-level services, and we're certainly going to continue to offer that. We're here to serve our community. We want to be of service to our community. We want to be a part of enhancing public safety, and I believe that we have services to offer that will help with that.
Bottom line, do you think that your center wound up taking a hit to its reputation as a result of this whole thing?
No question. We had been in existence for 37 years, and almost no one had ever heard of us. We housed more than 200 convicted felons there for 35-plus years, and very few people in the community even knew we existed because of the job that we've done. No question, we've taken a hit to our reputation, and I'm certainly not going to excuse Heartland Center and what we've done, what I've done under my leadership here. This is the criticism that we've received is absolutely fair, and we need to hear it, and we need to be responsive, and we need to do a better job moving forward. But certainly there's an incredible amount of good that Heartland Center does in our community, and we deserve credit for the good as well.
That's Kyle Mead, president and CEO of the Heartland Center that wound up taking a whole bunch of city inmates in recent weeks to help out with a crunch that the city of Kansas City was experiencing. Kyle, thanks for coming in and sharing your thoughts. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it.
After a short break, we'll renew our conversation about the Oakland-Kansas City rivalry back in the 70s and 80s and what in the world happened to it. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Kraske Off Mic is my weekly newsletter that you can get delivered fresh to your inbox this very afternoon if you sign up now at kcur.org/Kraske. Read what guests get me thinking about and highlights from the up-to-date staff and occasional behind-the-scenes extras. Subscribe at kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, when it comes to saving the environment, one overlooked group is young people of color. How to engage diverse youth to be the next generation of environmental stewards. That's Tuesday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, next up for the Kansas City Chiefs, the Oakland Raiders on December 1st. Once upon a time, this was a wildly intense NFL rivalry featuring heroes and villains like Otis Taylor and Ben Davidson and Marv Hubbard and Lenny Dawson. The rivalry defined an era, and it defined two cities that were once desperate to attract professional sports teams in both football and baseball as a way to place their cities on the national map. Matthew Ehrlich has written a new book on all this, Kansas City versus Oakland, the bitter sports rivalry that defined an era. He's a professor emeritus of journalism at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and he joins us now. Matthew, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
How did a guy from Illinois become so fascinated with the Kansas City-Oakland rivalry?
Well, before I moved to Illinois, I actually was born and raised in Kansas City.
So that's your excuse.
That's what happened, yeah.
Yeah. There are lots of rivalries in sports. Why did you pinpoint this one?
Well, I grew up with it, and, I first became aware of it actually at the age of six, and my older brother was unhappy about something, and I asked him what was going on, and he said, well, the Chiefs and the Raiders just played a wild card playoff game, not a wild card playoff game, but a game to decide the division winner, and Oakland won 41-6. And so I figured out very early on that Oakland was the enemy, and that when Kansas City sports teams went to the Oakland Coliseum, bad things happened. And because those two cities were pitted against each other during a time of great change in professional sports and in American society, I just in the years following figured it would make it for a good book sometime for somebody to write. And when nobody else wrote it, I figured I would do it myself.
Let me bring Greg Eklund into our conversation. He covers sports for KCUR. And Greg, I can't help but note that this rivalry today sure isn't what it used to be. What happened?
Well, for one thing, the Chiefs are winning a lot of them, most of them these days.
Yeah.
When the Oakland Raiders were really good, they used to trade victories, but the Chiefs have been so dominant for the last several years, it's taken something away from it.
Huh. Matthew, you begin this story with a look at a pivotal game between the Chiefs and the Raiders. It happened on November 1st, 1970. Why was this such a big game?
Well, back in those days, pretty much every time the Chiefs and Raiders met, it seemed as though they were playing for first place because they were the dominant teams in their division. And that particular game, it was no exception. And it took place in Old Municipal Stadium there at 22nd and Brooklyn on the east side of Kansas City. And the Chiefs were leading 17-14 late in the game. When Len Dawson, who was, in his mid-30s coming off a serious knee injury, decided he was going to call a bootleg run. And he did so, ran for nearly 20 yards, got a first down. But Ben Davidson, who you mentioned in introducing us, decided to spear Len Dawson in the back, which launched a great bitter brawl that is still remembered to this very day.
I was going to say, before the show today, Matthew, I took a look at it on YouTube just to refresh my memory. It all came back to me pretty quickly, and there was no doubt that Ben Davidson speared Lenny Dawson, who was on the ground. He wasn't going anywhere, and that play was, to call it dirty would be an understatement, I think.
Well, old Ben said he wasn't really sure if Len was down or not.
Yeah.
He decided to make really, really sure. And Otis Taylor decided he was going to stand up for the Chiefs and for Kansas City and for Len Dawson and tackled Ben Davidson. It stirred a great brawl. And it just ended up with the play being completely nullified and the Raiders driving late in the game to kick a field goal to tie the game. This was before sudden death decided to tie games in the NFL. And so it just stirred all the bitter feelings between the two cities and the two franchises, kind of crystallized them. And it's a game that, as you mentioned, is still remembered, especially by people who have been following the NFL for a long time and have been following the Chiefs and Raiders for a long time.
Well, I'm just struck by the fact that this game is nearly 50 years old, and you're talking to a host here, Matthew, who's still getting worked up about what happened here, because I'm reading your book about the play being nullified. Why was the play nullified? Lenny Dawson had gained the yardage. He put the Chiefs in a position to win the game, and yet that's not what happened here.
Well, another reason this game is remembered is because it led to a change in NFL rules, so it could not happen like that today. It was called a continuing action foul, which basically meant there were no such things as dead ball fouls back then, or if there were, it didn't apply in this case. So the play was technically not over, and it led to offsetting penalties because Otis Redding came back from the dead.
That,
he was so unhappy about this play.
Yeah.
Otis Taylor and Ben Davidson were, you know, trading blows, and so was everybody else. And that led to essentially the play never happened, offsetting penalties.
Just amazing. You know, Greg Eklund, you've spoken with Ben Davidson once about this and many other things as well. And contrary to his public persona, Ben Davidson was actually a heck of a nice guy.
He was a nice guy. And actually, after his playing days were over, he would come to Kansas City, at the invitation of some special groups in Kansas City who wanted to put little promotions, you know, to remember that rivalry. And he had a great relationship off the field with guys like Len Dawson and those Chiefs that had played at that time.
Which you never would have expected, bitter feelings on the football field that day.
Exactly, sure.
Yeah. Matthew, I'm talking about Kansas City fans here in the aftermath of that game. They went nuts over the outcome, right? It got pretty ugly.
Yeah, and, you know, Otis Taylor was the guy who triggered it all. Nobody blamed him. He was considered a hero, even though if he had done nothing, the play would have stood and the Chiefs would have won that game.
But of course your players are going to stand up for your quarterback when he gets speared like that, lying prone on the ground. That's just going to happen, right?
Yeah, and so
good teammates do that.
All the wrath was directed at the NFL. You know, people were calling the Kansas City Star. This is obviously pre-internet, so people needed to vent somewhere. And the Kansas City Star said, look, here's the address of the NFL if you want to write them. And a lot of people did. It really stuck in the craw of Kansas City sports fans, especially when the Chiefs ended up not winning the division, whereas if they had won that game, they would have been in a much better position to do so.
Well, the focus of the rivalry between Oakland and Kansas City, your book details, it goes way beyond this one play involving Ben Davidson on November 1st, 1970. The rivalry also extended to bad feelings between the two cities when it came to Oakland luring away Kansas City's baseball team to the West Coast. When did that happen, and how well did that sit with Kansas City, Matthew?
Well, that happened in 1967, and that was after many adventuresome years, I guess that's one way of putting it, with Charlie Finley, who was the guy who bought the A's after Arnold Johnson, the first owner of the A's in Kansas City, died. And immediately after Finley bought the then Kansas City A's in 1961, he started trying to move them all over the place. He even tried to move them to a cow pasture in Peculiar, Missouri at one point. So moving them to Oakland was just the culmination of all that. So that sparked the rivalry between the two cities at the time when the Chiefs and the Raiders really became the two most powerful teams in the old American Football League, along with Joe Namath and the New York Jets. The rivalry was not just a football one. It also bled over into baseball.
We're talking about the rivalry between Kansas City and Oakland on the sports field, both football and baseball. Matthew Ehrlich's new book, Kansas City versus Oakland, The Bitter Sports Rivalry That Defined an Era. But we shouldn't forget that Kansas City had done its own poaching, Matthew, to get a baseball team to begin with back in the 1950s. What happened there?
That was the old Philadelphia Athletics,
right.
And they were one of the great baseball teams for many, many years under Connie Mack, who was the owner and the manager. But by the early 1950s, that team was really going downhill with attendance and everything else. And so the American League decided that team needed to find a new home. And it so happened that the New York Yankees had close ties with Arnold Johnson, whom we just mentioned. Arnold Johnson actually owned Yankee Stadium in New York City at one point. And so they decided that Arnold Johnson would be a really good owner for the A's, and the A's would be would find a good home in Kansas City. So from almost the very beginning, there were these really unnatural and unhealthy ties between the Kansas City Athletics after they had moved from Philadelphia and the New York Yankees. And the Kansas City A's started shipping off a lot of their best players to the Yankees, most notoriously Roger Maris. Mm-hmm. So the Kansas City A's history was a really unhappy one. They never had a winning season, and I think it was 13 seasons that they were actually in the city. Mm. But yes, Kansas City did the poaching of the A's from Philadelphia long before the city of Oakland came along and poached the A's in turn.
And on the football side, we did some poaching too to get the Texans from Dallas. What happened there?
Well, it's interesting. You know, neither the Kansas City Chiefs or the Oakland Raiders were ever intended to exist originally. The Kansas City Chiefs were originally in Dallas and owned by Lamar Hunt. Lamar Hunt always made his home in Dallas. And he only moved the team after the NFL expanded into Dallas with the Cowboys, and he realized that his team would never survive competing head-to-head against the Cowboys. So he looked for a new home. He wanted to go to New Orleans first, and they didn't have a stadium there. So finally, H.R.O. Bartle and the city council in Kansas City brought the team to Kansas City. And as for the Raiders, they were supposed to be in Minneapolis originally and only moved to Oakland after the NFL expanded into Minneapolis.
I think people forget, Greg Eklund, that sometimes there's been a lot of poaching getting done here in Kansas City when it comes to our franchises.
Well, the Kansas City Kings were once the Cincinnati Royals.
That's
before
right.
They were an NBA team here in Kansas City. And there's another one that escapes me at the moment, but let's think about Sprint Center sparked. It was a lot of discussion about an NHL team moving here, and that was at one time the Pittsburgh Penguins before they got a new arena in Pittsburgh as a result of that.
Hmm. Well, let's go back to the baseball side here, Matthew. By the early to mid-70s, the Royals were battling the Oakland A's for supremacy in the American League. Did the Royals, they were still an awfully young franchise. Why did they emerge as such a good one so early on in their existence?
I think it was a couple of things. One is Ewing Kauffman had a lot of money to actually invest in the team, and he was good about doing that. So he acquired a lot of young talent in the farm system. And then they had a general manager named Cedric Tallis, who just did an amazing job of fleecing other teams out of really top-drawer talent. So there was a series of great trades that brought Amos Otis and Hal McRae and Freddie Patek, John Mayberry, other guys to the Royals. So they got really good, really fast, pretty much ahead of schedule. But they kept running into the A's, the same A's who had been in Kansas City only a few years earlier. And one of the reasons Kansas Cityans resented Oakland so much was that could have been Kansas City's team. They left Kansas City right about the time when guys like Reggie Jackson and Sal Bando, Catfish Hunter, all those great A's players were about to become really, really good.
How intense did the rivalry between these two teams become in the 1970s?
My favorite story is it culminated in 1976 in a game at the Coliseum. And
lots of brawls here. That's
yeah,
where we're going
I mean,
here.
The 1970s were great for baseball brawls. I remember those vividly. And in the middle of a game late in the season between the A's and the Royals, the Royals' bullpen started to get into a fight with the A's fans seated nearby. And the A's fans started throwing beer on the Royals players. One of the Royals grabbed a spectator's umbrella, started swinging the umbrella at the players. So, it just got nuts. You know, beanball wars, all that sort of thing.
When the Royals wound up winning the division that year, the A's made a late season run that you write about in the book, and the Royals managed to hold them off. I love this little detail you put in the book. Freddie Patek and Cookie Rojas wound up jumping into the center field fountain at Kauffman Stadium. I've never seen that kind of thing before. I would have loved to have seen that.
Yeah, and the story goes is that a quick-witted person in the Royal Stadium called Royal Stadium Operations, realized it would be a really good idea to shut off the electricity in the illuminated fountains before those two players started splashing around in it. So it had a happy ending.
We'll have to leave our conversation there. Matthew Ehrlich's book, Kansas City versus Oakland, The Bitter Sports Rivalry That Defined an Era. Thanks so much for your time. I sure appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it, too.